Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, Fresno's role in the International Imperial Court System, one of the oldest and largest LGBTQ nonprofits in the world. And later, another episode from our Escape from Mammoth Pool podcast. But first, COVID-19 cases among youth were increasing last month as students started the school year. Cases have since declined, but as KVPR's Mari Bolaños reports, even small COVID outbreaks at schools can have major impacts on families in rural communities.
Laura Garcia stands outside her home with two of her kids and their ducks, chicken, and goats in Raisin City, a small unincorporated community southwest of Fresno. It's a morning in early September, and she's wearing a mask because her oldest daughter, Jennifer, who attends Raisin City Elementary School, tested positive for COVID in late August. She suspects her daughter contracted the virus at school. She says she reached out to other parents in her daughter's class to let them know.
When I told the parents that my daughter tested positive, some of them said their children were feeling the symptoms, so they tested them as well, and they were positive.
At least three students in Garcia's daughter's class tested positive for the virus. Following Fresno County Health Department guidelines, school officials sent all the kids in the class home to quarantine for nearly a week after Labor Day. The virus, of course, spread beyond the school children. In total, four of Garcia's kids contracted the virus. Garcia and her husband, who is the family's sole provider, also got it. He's vaccinated and works in the fields.
It affects us because he's the only one that works to pay the rent, to buy the stuff for the kids, and to pay for the bills.
Garcia and her husband are undocumented. Since they don't qualify for many forms of government assistance, they've turned to friends and family for help buying groceries. The Garcia family isn't the only one facing loss of income and education due to the pandemic. An estimated 44% of Latino parents nationwide reported an interruption in employment due to childcare, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation survey published in late August. It also shows that half of Latino parents with incomes below $40,000 reported their children fell behind academically.
My name is Carmen Cuautenco. Tengo 40 años.
40-year-old Carmen Cuautenco Leon's 13-year-old daughter is another one of the 8th graders at Raisin City Elementary School who tested positive for COVID. Cuautenco Leon is a single mother of three. She says she also had to take time off from her work in the fields to care for her child. But her biggest concern is the learning loss that her children face through the pandemic and again while quarantined.
The kids are behind. They are very behind. And of course, they need to go to school. But we also need to take care of the health of our kids.
Tania Pacheco Warner is co-director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. She says many people in rural communities have lower education levels and fewer job opportunities. She says that creates a perfect storm, making it difficult for residents to take time off work to care for their children.
We see that burden fall especially hard on rural families who don't have a lot of other options other than not getting an income during the time that their children have to stay home.
To prevent parents from losing income while taking care of quarantined kids, Pacheco Warner says it's important that local officials collaborate on how to protect students. That's especially needed in smaller rural districts.
It's going to take a state-coordinated, school-wide, school-based effort to really think through how to begin testing and surveillance in those places that simply don't have the infrastructure to do it themselves.
Victoria Morales, a mother of five, says Raisin City Elementary School is one of those places that lacks the infrastructure. She doesn't have any kids in the school's eighth grade class, but she says school officials sent her eight-year-old daughter home on a Monday after mistaking the girl's asthma attack for a symptom of COVID.
They said she couldn't come back until she had a negative result. And that Thursday, the doctors called and said she was negative.
But Morales says she didn't get the written proof of the negative result until the following week. She says her daughter and two of her other children, who were also sent home because they lived in the same household, missed out on a week's worth of learning. That's in addition to the learning loss they experienced during the pandemic. Nearly 3 weeks after the Raisin City class was sent home to quarantine, Laura Garcia and Carmen Guanteco's family have recovered from their symptoms. But their kids are still recovering from the learning loss. And Garcia's husband's employer still hasn't paid him for the 2 weeks he was in quarantine. With KVPR, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Wildland firefighters accept risk when they head out to battle a blaze. But CAL FIRE firefighters are getting sick, and some have even died, during training. As part of a collaboration between the investigative unit at Columbia Journalism School, the California Newsroom, and KPCC, Jacob Margolis and Brian Edwards have this report.
On a hot July day a few years ago, CAL FIRE firefighter Yaroslav Katkov was hiking on a trail near Temecula when he collapsed. By the time he got help, it was too late. He died at the age of 28, not on the fire line, but while training.
They told me that everything that could have been done was done.
Ashley Valerio was Katkov's longtime partner.
And, I believed them, and I, trusted them.
My reporting partner Brian and I reviewed hundreds of pages of documents from CAL FIRE and CAL OSHA. We found a pattern of seasonal firefighters and inmates getting sick and some even dying during what should have been one of the least dangerous things they do, training.
Exactly, Jacob. Over the last year and a half, almost 4 dozen CAL FIRE firefighters have suffered from heat illness during training. And since 2003, 5 firefighters have died during training exercises, where experts say heat appears to have played a role in their deaths. And all these cases point to bigger issues within the agency.
For one, there's a culture that values pushing on at all costs.
Two, CAL FIRE has major issues with helping people improve their fitness levels safely.
And three, even before they get started training, insiders say, CAL FIRE's process for catching pre-existing medical conditions is lacking.
Okay, let's start with the punitive culture issue, because it's a big part of this story.
Yeah, and seems to be a big part of Yaroslav Katkov's story in particular. He collapsed and died after being pushed by his captain to do a training hike a second time, after he'd already been showing signs of heat illness. CAL FIRE demoted the captain after the investigation. We were told by multiple current and former CAL FIRE employees that pushing firefighters beyond their breaking points is common.
In a written response, CAL FIRE said it vigorously rejects the notion that a punitive culture exists. But there have been similar issues since Katkov's death.
And I'll admit it, we had problems in San Diego in the last 4 months.
That's CAL FIRE Union President Tim Edwards, who spoke with us after we shared what we found. He says that a supervisor had to be admonished for the way he was treating seasonal firefighters.
Making them hike when they weren't feeling good, making them hike thinking if you pushed them a little bit further, it would help them.
Another reason CAL FIRE firefighters are getting injured during training, uneven physical fitness standards and a lack of consistent training standards. That's a problem for seasonal firefighters who might take 6 months off between deployments and not show up in firefighting shape. Here's Edwards again.
Is there a physical fitness standard coming onto the job? No, there's not. Absolutely not. And we've been pushing for years for one.
In a statement, CAL FIRE said, quote, each must do his, her part year round to ensure that they're preparing for the upcoming fire season. Our investigation found many firefighters don't always get clear guidelines for improvements after taking the winter off. According to the injury reports we reviewed, a majority of the seasonal firefighters that got sick with heat in the last year and a half did not have documented conditioning plans.
And the final big issue? seasonal firefighters usually only get basic physicals before they start working.
In the Katkov investigation documents, CAL FIRE Captain Cesar Neri is quoted as saying, "You could get a better physical playing high school football than the one required by CAL FIRE."
Other departments often require firefighters to go through more extensive testing before they start in the field. Meaning, for CAL FIRE firefighters, there's a chance that bigger, unknown pre-existing conditions could be missed.
When we spoke with Ashley Valerio, Katkov's longtime partner, she was angry.
You're supposed to, like, have faith that those people would, like, keep them safe. Definitely it shows what kind of leadership that they're willing to allow.
How to keep firefighters safe during training is a question that will only become more pressing as California's wildfire outlook continues to worsen. I'm Jacob Margolis.
And I'm Brian Edwards.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Earlier, you heard a story about how rural communities are affected by COVID cases in public schools. And parents everywhere worry about the rise in cases coupled with children back in the classroom. To better understand the risk to kids, especially those with special needs, I spoke with Dr. David Sein, Medical Director for the Pediatric Palliative Care Program at Valley Children's Hospital. Early on in the pandemic, many of us thought that children were fairly immune from contracting severe COVID. Is that still the case?
No, not at all anymore, I don't think. I think at the beginning, we didn't see a lot of pediatric cases, pretty minimally, but things have, you know, there were some, but things have definitely changed with the Delta variant.
So what are you seeing?
So with the first two surges, you know, I look after some of the sickest kids in the Central Valley from Bakersfield to Modesto because I do palliative care. So I have some of the sickest of the sick kids, over about 250 of the sickest kids in the valley. And I was really nervous, honestly, when COVID started hitting. And because I work at Children's, I saw some of the kids getting sick. But with the program that we had, we were able to keep those kids mostly home using our nurses that we have through hospice and palliative care. And a lot of the families with kids with special needs are kind of used to like the winter lockdown where they'll kind of isolate themselves from school and be very careful with their kids during the winter because in general, kids with special needs are at higher risk of infections and things in the winter. The difference being with COVID, obviously, you know, that was starting up, you know, including in the summer of last year. So it just kind of changed the timing of it. But during that time frame, I was worried about those kids. And the few kids that did get primary COVID or what I call respiratory COVID actually did remarkably well, and very few of them ever had to be admitted to the hospital. There was a small number of kids that were getting some of the secondary COVID stuff that we now know, the MISI with the cardiac effects, and then some of the kids with renal issues. And I had a few kids that went into kidney failure. But that was with the first two variants. This, now with Delta, it's been very, very different, where the kids before that seemed to do well with the primary or respiratory type COVID are now in the hospital. A lot of them are getting admitted to the hospital, are getting a lot sicker, both at home and the ones that come to the hospital. And we have, unfortunately, lost some kids in the last few weeks.
I'm so sorry to hear that. It must be incredibly difficult for you to see the emergence of this variant come around, you know, and what we thought was the waning days of the pandemic.
It is, because we were, you know, as a pediatrician, you know, for healthy kids as well, and having kids of my own, the kids needed to go back to school. Like, we were seeing the side effects and the psychological impact as well as learning impact that was having on kids trying to Zoom learn, especially those of us who have ADD or ADHD, myself included. Zoom meetings and trying to do Zoom remote school is very, very difficult for those kids. And then you have the special needs kids, you know, those same variables are with that. So it was looking forward to the kids did well, we're getting some people vaccinated, the schools are doing precautions, let's get the kids back in school. And then Delta hits, and then we start seeing how it's affecting kids very, very differently. Some of the studies are showing kids with Down syndrome, for example, have 10 times the risk of both mortality and morbidity. Those are pretty early studies. As to why it's doing that specifically with Down syndrome, we're not sure, because in general, most of those kids, other than potentially having a cardiac defect, don't generally have an immune deficiency or a respiratory deficiency. I've been a pediatrician for over 25 years, and there's just so much in this that's unknown, and that's just not something that we're used to having that degree of unknown in medicine. So it makes it really, really hard. And then on top of that, seeing these kids getting sick and going to the hospital and trying to balance that with trying to maintain either them going to school or their siblings going to school if they're unable to be vaccinated. It's really hard, and it's been really hard on the medical field.
Can you just speak to that, what the morale is like with the folks that you work with and how people are coping with this latest surge?
Because I do hospice palliative care, obviously I see a lot of the sickest kids, and I'm the busiest I've ever been in 25 years. And hospice palliative care just simply because of the environment, not all necessarily related to COVID, but also related to the effects of COVID, not going to the doctors frequently, not going to clinics, Zoom appointments, all of those types of things. As far as the morale goes, it's not good. You know, I think that because there's been no rest period for people to, you know, go on vacation, whatever vacation is, giving the limits again with COVID, just when people thought they were going to get a break, it's hitting again. And I think for pediatrics in general, summertime is usually our break. That's usually when there's less kids in the hospital, there's less pediatric illnesses in the summer. Most of the time you're doing more well stuff to get kids prepared for school. That didn't happen clearly this year, and we're anticipating a pretty scary winter coming up that's already starting. And that's hard to do if your tank is nowhere near even half full.
So for parents listening to this, particularly parents of special needs kids, what is your message to them?
I get asked that question all the time, obviously. I think that trying to, if your special needs child is a child that gets a lot out of going to school, then if it's done in a safe manner, if you're able to vaccinate, vaccinate. If you're not able to vaccinate either for a medical reason or because of the age at this point, try and do the best you can to surround that child by people that are vaccinated. Because we already know that the degree of illness that you will get if you're vaccinated is less. So hopefully, you know, those kids will benefit from that. And then, you know, some of our special needs families feel like if we're going to go through this again, they want to bring all the kids back home and not be in person in school. But then you have that same effect on their siblings that are, you know, if the siblings are going to be going to school, then that risk still exists for them. So the same thing, if they are under the age range for vaccination, then trying to really encourage your school or wherever your kids are going to do all the things that we know are at least somewhat helpful with masking, social distancing, et cetera, and just trying to do the best we can. I think the problem that I see as a physician is we see so much information that comes across the internet or various places that we don't know for sure yet. So it's just a lot of the things come out as ideas, and then people take that as a fact. And then later on, a different idea comes up that contraindicates that first one. And then no one has any trust in anything. They don't have trust in the medical field, the CDC, the government, anybody. And I think that what we just need to get back to the basics. And the basics are, you know, you isolate when you're sick. You are honest. If your child has a fever or sick, you seek proper attention. Just kind of do the best we can do at this time.
Well, thank you so much for all that you do. I've been talking with David Sein, the medical director for the Pediatric Palliative Care Program at Valley Children's Hospital. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Yes, for sure. Thank you, too.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The International Imperial Court System, one of the oldest and largest LGBTQ nonprofits in the world, uses galas and drag performances to raise money in support of the community. Fresno's chapter is called the Imperial Dove Court, and it has made a lasting impact here in the Valley. To learn more, I spoke with LGBTQ historian Chris Jarvis, licensed marriage and family therapist Jeffrey Robinson, Fresno State Women's Studies professor Kat Faubert, and Nick Patrick Gonzalez, also known as Miss Nikki, who is a former empress of the court. He filled me in on how it all got started.
Oh, I can tell you that we did start in 1973. Jesse 1 and 4 was our first elected empress. We are currently on reign 48, and I'm actually empress 14, so I'm pretty old up there. The organization has to throw 7 to 8 state functions every year. And then in between that, we have multiple bar shows. We may even have different fundraisers to raise money, like for instance, car washes, bake sales, food sales, or whatever. And if anybody asks us to entertain, we do that also. But when they come, we hope that they enjoy the evening. We do try to provide a dinner for most of our functions. We also have a bar that is open. We are able to get a bar license through the state. And most of our money is made from there also, and the door proceeds. And most of the time, we also have auctions or raffles to raise money. And we do pretty well. We have pretty much raised somewhere between $750 and $1 million in the last 48 years in order to provide to the community.
You know, Chris, as an LGBTQ historian, I'd love for you to talk about what kind of an impact the Imperial Dove Court has had for the LGBTQ community. I mean, I've heard it described as the United Way for this community. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I like that description. I would say that one of the strengths of the IDC is that, and this especially back in the early days, which I'm old enough to remember the early days, drag was a very rebellious thing to do for the LGBT community, because men were looked at if they were gay as feminine, which was used against us derogatorily. And the fact that people in the IDC and other people in the community would dress up in drag and do shows was a very rebellious act. And the IDC led easily in that effort. You know, when Nikki says they do a lot of shows, he's not kidding. I DJed for many, many IDC shows. And what is great about the IDC is not only do their members, and they have a lot of members, contribute to each event by donating their own personal money, but they do the performances, they run the events, and they are able to show the younger community now, again, as drag is becoming much more mainstream with RuPaul's Drag Race and all that, but that's given it a lot of power as well. So in the old days, we used to look at drag as very rebellious. Now it's more mainstream, but it still serves the same purpose. It says that you can be whoever you want to be and perform in whatever costume or outfit you want to perform in. And it doesn't take away from, as they used to say, your masculinity. You know, the definition of gender has changed so dramatically over the years. And the IDC is at the forefront of helping do that. And they give a lot of money out to the community every year. And they're a vital organization. They're incredibly important in the community.
I just wanted to add, you know, even though it's more accepted now, I do want to go back in our history, and I hope Chris remembers this, but there was a time that even one of our old gay bars would not let us in, unfortunately. We could not walk in drag into the Express. That was years ago. We were supported by so many, even the straight venues that we used. We're very supportive, but it was very disappointing that I have to tell you that unfortunately, the Express was one of the few bars that would not allow us in there if we were in face.
Yeah, this is Chris, and I definitely remember that. And, you know, it was a strange combination, because not only did they not want the drag queens there, they specifically did not want women there. This was the biggest gay bar in the community at that time, and they were literally kicking drag queens and women out of the bar. I was shocked when I found out that happened. That is part of our history. There's a lot of internalized, I don't even know if dragophobia is a term, but, you know, certainly misogyny, that the gay men and women, or people who appeared as women, were separate. And and the gay men were the ones that kind of created this boundary. So I think that's a blight on our history. Now, I don't really see that, although there, you know, you still, every community has its own detractors within its own community where they say, oh, you know, why do men have to do drag? You know what? Look at what they're doing for the community.
Right. And I would have to agree with that. And the sad thing is I don't think it's as prevalent as it was back in the 80s. We were looked down upon quite a bit, no matter what we did, no matter how much good we did for the community. Drag was not popular back then, per se, like it is today. But it was difficult, but we still managed to go on and raise the money that we had to.
Kat Robert, as a professor of women's studies at Fresno State, I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts about what Nick and Chris have been talking about this, you know, idea of misogyny within the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, no, I appreciate this. I think what Miss Nikki and Chris have been talking about, particularly around, I would say, misogyny, as well as a sort of anti what would we consider now like trans or any sort of community that challenge the gender binary, which drag performers, female and male impersonators, always do. But I, one of the things that what I really want people to understand also about the history of particularly the Imperial Dove Court, but all sort of performers in regards to the court systems and so forth, is that it is an amazing example of community providing for its community. Because if you, and I think it's interesting teaching younger people because they don't fully understand completely the struggles that the older generations has had, and the fact that during the 1980s, particularly at the height of the AIDS and HIV epidemic, there was very few resources for the community, but it was the community, particularly the Imperial Dove Court, as well as many people who were connected to Imperial Dove Court through various ways, whether serving or going to shows or also then joining and forming their own sort of work to provide funding and support for HIV and AIDS relief. So many shows, like if you look through the like records of like all the shows that the Imperial Dove Court put on, as well as other courts in the area put on, they're all going to HIV AIDS relief back during a time when people were being forced to like out of hospitals or not being able to get care, or family members abandoning them. The stigma around it was so horrible. And it's really sort of shows the amazing resources and resiliency that the LGBTQ community has had here in Fresno for supporting and providing for communities. For myself, I can speak on just behalf of being a part of a very small organization, TransEmotion. You know, this is an organization that is meant for transgender advocacy and support. I will say that for many years, our organization survived on the funding that the Imperial Dove Court gave to us every year, because that's one of the great things that they offer are grants to small organizations. And we use that for providing food, shelter, support groups, art activities for many within our community. And I think that's also the really beautiful thing about the history of not only the IDC, but also the history of here in Fresno, of just how the community has worked in the face of many barriers and obstacles to provide support, love, guidance, affirmation, and so forth.
So Jeffrey, I know that you, as along with Chris, have been really interested in preserving LGBTQ history here in the Central Valley. Can you just tell us why these stories are so important to preserve?
Well, I think for one, LGBTQ stories are not widely available or have been recorded or documented due to fear and safety issues from the past decades. Many people would destroy their personal information so that family, friends, colleagues, and the public would never know about their lives and their true existence and their true identities. I think for us here in the local area, no one's really taken notice of what it's like to be LGBTQ here in the Central Valley. We are in a conservative area. It's more rural than metropolitan. And I think that many of the stories that have been told are San Francisco, LA, New York, Chicago. They're not the stories of Visalia, Parlier, Fresno, Clovis, Madera. And I think listening to how people have survived and actually flourished and created a culture is so important to document so that future generations can see that.
Chris, I'd imagine you'd have thoughts on this as well.
You know, as I think I said earlier, I ran a LGBT community center here for about 7 or 8 years. And so we were open to the public, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 days a week. And what Jeff is saying is absolutely true. Number one, people, the stories aren't out there. Part of that is because, like he said, people are reticent to tell their stories, fear of retaliation from their families, from friends, from jobs, from their life in general. And there were many times in the community center where people would come in. These were the things that impressed me were the people who were in their 40s and 50s who would come in, and they were in heterosexual married relationships, but they were actually, you know, LGBTQ. And they would come in and try and share their stories. And sometimes they wouldn't be able to do it right away. Sometimes they would take time to do it. And sometimes they would break down and cry. I don't know that they ended up sharing anything outside of those walls. They certainly shared with us, but a huge part of it was they didn't seem to know there was a community out there to begin with. So if we don't get our stories out there and we don't share the stories of other people, not just of those of us who are active in the community and probably well-known and seen all over the place, but you know, the people who are in Selma or Parlier, like Jeff said, who are just living their lives and are looking for some kind of connection to the community in the Central Valley. That's why these stories are important, that we tell them, that we share, you know, that we're all going through the same kind of experiences in a way, and we are surviving. We dealt with trans kids who would call into the center and were on the edge of suicide because they didn't know there was a community and they didn't know they had any options. So that's why those of us that are working in the community, it's really important for us to have our stories out there and to find other people to share their stories so that people can relate and be able to communicate with each other about what they're going through.
Well, I do want to come back to the court system. Kat, I understand there's an event coming up at Fresno State that really celebrates the history and the performers of the Imperial Court System. Can you tell us a little about that?
So the upcoming event is called Performances of the Heart, which is male, female impersonators, drag kings, queens, and artists of Fresno. The whole point of the event is to highlight and celebrate this really important, beautiful community, the history and the legacy of it, and to really just sort of recognize it for what it should have always been recognized for, as being foundational and fundamental to not only to the LGBTQ community, but to Fresno as a whole. One of the things that I think it's also really important when we talk about preserving LGBTQ history that in Fresno is that it's also Fresno's history, because obviously the LGBTQ community is part of Fresno and has shaped Fresno and are important community members of Fresno. It's not a separate history, and especially for the Imperial Dove Court, because this is a legacy of almost going to be 50 years of people being involved in this really dynamic, very extensive community network of people who are either they've served on the court, or they've attended court stuff, or they've been beneficiaries of the court, like myself in regards to trans emotion. So for me, I think it's also a celebration of Fresno and the history of Fresno by celebrating and recognizing the important work of not only the Imperial Dove Court and the court system as well, but also artists and performers, queer artists and performers here in Fresno. But yeah, and I think Nikki can speak to this even better than me.
Yeah, we actually have been there in the forefront raising money for different groups, especially when the 80s hit and the AIDS crisis. But prior to that, there were many charities that we gave to that were primarily, I hate to say it, but straight organizations, because I don't want to make it a difference, because helping the community is helping the community in any way. But when the AIDS crisis came, we basically said, okay, we've got to help ourselves. And that's basically what we did. We primarily gave through the 80s, maybe probably the early 90s. Most of our money did go through the AIDS organizations in town. And I think that I wanted to touch something about Chris and Jeff said about the community and stories that are out there that haven't been told. I recently talked to one of our empresses, Empress 16 Montano, and she remembers that when she first moved here, she was alone and how difficult it was to meet people. And then she remembered going to one of the gay bars. And when she got there, the court was putting on a show. And the first thing she thought was, I found my family. And I thought, immediately? She goes, yes. She goes, I just found my family. And I think that's important to know that, you know, the court itself, we have our problems like any other family, but we are a family first. And we try to be so inclusive. And yes, problems get in the way sometimes. But the main goal has always been to unite the community, raise money for the community, and always be there for them when they need us.
I think it should be noted that the Imperial Dove Court is the oldest LGBTQ organization in the Central Valley. There was no other community service organizations or groups. They were all very little informal associations of folks that got together to do things. But the Imperial Dove Court came together and really started and is the cornerstone or foundation of all the other groups that have come since then. And they really did do lots of work with providing a sense of community and opportunity in many different ways. And just like Montana, when I first came out, it was sneaking into the circle and going into my first gay club as a teenager and seeing actually a campaign show that had Eldonya, who's performing this Saturday, and Tiffany Taylor Tate and Cindy Williams, who's Emperor Nine, and Doug and Jerry and Sonny and all these folks. It was my first introduction to the community. And I really have always credited that night at the bar is the night that saved my life as a young kid. It's also where I not only did I find community, I also found a publication called the Fresno Frontrunner, which was the community's LGBTQ newspaper. And getting that and sneaking it home and hiding it and then reading every single article and finding out all kinds of things about the community that I never even knew were something that could have existed for me as a young queer person really changed my whole life. So for me, I'm very connected to the IDC. It was that night of revelry that really changed my whole life.
And just to piggyback off that a little bit, you know, in the old days, I know I keep saying the old days, but in the beginning, you know, the gay bars were the only place we could go. There were no safe havens. We didn't feel safe in restaurants or, you know, typical community centers. We went to the gay bars because that's where we were safe. And the IDC in Fresno was usually performing at one of those gay bars. So not only were we exposed to our community in the gay bar and felt safe, and we used to call it church because that's where we felt completely safe, but the IDC was there to show us what entertainment and rebellion was and activism was. And so you got all that at once when you went to the gay bar. So it was a religious experience, so to speak, for most of us when we went to the bars, because that was the only place we could go.
You know, not only that, the Imperial Dove Court, it was the one organization, the only organization, but I like to call it the e-ticket ride, like the old Disneyland when you got your little book of tickets and E was the Matterhorn ride. The IDC was the Matterhorn ride. And everybody in every different part of our community came to those events. You got to see the whole beautiful nature, the whole rainbow of our community going, because it was the only thing that was available for us. And so you would find people of all kinds of different classes being there of interest. People would get dressed up, suited and booted for the evening, and everybody made sure they were there at that event.
I like to just ask Miss Nikki and Chris and Jeff about the mentorship that particularly the Imperial Dove Court brought. Like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like just like learning from people that a lot of people like cut their teeth in regards to like community organizing and activism through also serving or being a part of the IDC.
Most of the organizations were from the IDC. The organizations got started after people were in the Imperial Dove Court and they wanted to see a different focus or maybe able to specialize in focuses. So people went on and moved. There have been many folks that have started with the court, just joining, going to the events, that have worked their way up into leadership. And I was talking to a couple people the other day about what makes the Imperial Dove Court and the court system in general so unique is everybody that's involved in the court is a designated leader. They've either led the organization for a year or they've been in training to lead the organization. And so when you get such a large, talented group of people together with lots of ideals, you have a little bit of chaos and conflict amongst each other. And I've never seen the culture, which I would say is the court system, in any other organization, but it's because you have a room full of bona fide leaders with their best intentions and best ideals being put forward.
You know, the funny thing was, when I joined the organization, I always thought I was going to be one of those background people, just helping somebody out get on the stage. I never thought I was going to be a performer. I hated performing, just for the record, but I had to do it in order to become an empress. But I can tell you that because of this organization, it actually helped build me up as a person and as a leader. And it took a while, because I was with the organization almost 2 years or 3 years before I even set foot on the stage as a performer. And I was a late bloomer. I was not an entertainer. I just did it because I had to. But yes, I think we groom so many people to become leaders and who have gone on to open up other organizations themselves.
Nikki, do you remember who your mentor was? Who was the person that took you under their wing?
I know you know her. It was Christy Love.
Oh, yes.
She was actually my drag mother. She tried to push me out there as much as she could. She was, as Jeffrey would say, larger than life personality.
So, Kat, there's also another event coming up in October at Fresno City College that's going to bring a really big name in the court system to the Central Valley. And I'd love if you could talk about it. But first, I should disclose that I am on a committee that is a co-sponsor of that event. But tell us a little bit about it.
So we've got two really cool things happening at Fresno City College right now. The first one that's ongoing and it's going to end on October 8th is the Constellating Care Network's art show gallery exhibit that is happening at the art space at Fresno City College. The whole purpose of this exhibit is to highlight LGBTQ history of Fresno, as well as queer artists and performers of Fresno. It's a great show. There's amazing, cool things there. Some really cool and important artifacts from the Imperial Dove Court is there. Some of our most precious stuff right now, which is the crowns and scepters and so forth. Thank you, Miss Nikki, for letting us borrow those. The other thing that's going to be happening in the future is Fresno City College is bringing Empress Nicole, the great Queen Mother of the Americas, Nicole Murray Ramirez, is going to be coming, which is amazing. It's incredible to have such a founding member of just the court system in general, of the imperial court system, just nationwide. She will be coming to talk on October 6th at 6:30 p.m. at the OAB Auditorium at Fresno City College. The event is free and open to the public. There will also be showings of some really cool films that deal with the court. More information will be available. But if you want to see some more legendary history, please come and join everybody at Fresno City College on Wednesday, October 6th at 6:30 p.m. to hear the amazing Empress Nicole.
She is actually the Queen Mother of the Americas. She's the head of the entire organization of 65 to 70 chapters that we have here in the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
Yeah, this is royalty coming here, people. Like, wear a nice shirt.
I can't think of a better place to end. Thank you all so much for being on the show. I've been talking with Catherine Faubert, Jeffrey Robbins, Chris Jarvis, and Miss Nikki. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And finally, we continue KVPR's newest podcast, Escape from Mammoth Pool. For this week's episode, reporter Carrie Klein is here to peel back the curtain on the podcast and share a few anecdotes that didn't make it into earlier episodes. Plus, we hear how the survivors are doing a year out. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So first, tell me about Carla Carcamo's family members. She had been camping with lots of her extended family, and many of those were burned when the flames approached while they were hiking. It sounds like some of them had some very serious injuries. How are they doing now?
Yeah, that's right. So that was Carla's brother and sister, also two cousins. They were all badly burned and injured, and so were many others who were hiking with them. Well, and according to the National Guard, there were actually 21 people who were transferred to the hospital immediately after they were airlifted out last summer. So many of those injuries were bad, as you said. You know, many people ended up in the hospital for days or weeks. Some needed skin grafts. Some were released, but ultimately readmitted with infections. So Carla said it's been a tough year, obviously, and this has been a traumatic event for their whole family. However, I don't actually know much more than that, like what kind of long-term care they need. I haven't been able to speak to anyone else in her family, and that's because many of them are involved in a lawsuit about the fire, and they can't discuss the details with me.
Okay, so this is the lawsuit you teased at the end of the last episode.
That's right. So this lawsuit was filed in May with the Madera County Superior Court, and you might assume that it's related to how the fire started. But it's not. It's actually about communicating fire risk. And it argues that because of some special circumstances, the county could have notified the campers that the fire was approaching, but it didn't. So I'll back up a couple steps here. So if you recall in the first episode of the series, in the middle of the night before all the craziness happened, Carla and her cousins spotted a fire off in the distance, what they believe was the very beginning of the Creek Fire, and they called 911. Now, I have a copy of that 911 call, but according to the lawsuit, there may have been more to that exchange than what I got my hands on. And more importantly, at some point in that exchange, someone in Carla's family gave their phone number to a county employee so he could get back in touch if the fire position changed. But a follow-up call never happened. He never did. So the county is the target of the lawsuit, and it claims their failure to follow up with the campers was negligence. The complaint was filed on behalf of 11 plaintiffs. I recognize many names as Carla's relatives, and although I don't know the others, it appears as though all 11 people suffered injuries that weekend because of the fire. But like I said, I've never spoken to any of the plaintiffs about this, and both Carla and the lawyer representing them declined to answer any questions about the lawsuit or the circumstances that led to it.
What about the county? How are they responding?
So Madera County never responded to multiple requests for comment. However, the county's lawyers did respond in a legal filing. And in that document, they say there's not enough evidence to prove that the county owed a legal duty to the campers in this situation. And even if the campers had been able to demonstrate a legal duty, the county argues it would still be immune from any liability based on a specific clause in the state's health and safety code that protects first responders. But this case is still in its early stages, and more details are likely to emerge as it continues.
Wow. Well, I do look forward to hearing more about that. So then let's move on to the other families that you interviewed. First, Vicky Castro and Rolando Rosales. They're the parents who got separated from their kids during that 2-mile evacuation from the campgrounds to the lake. A year later, how do they look back at this experience?
Well, I'll start with their kids, who are still struggling a bit. You know, to recap, Vicky and Rolando were there with their 2 sons and a niece and nephew, and they ranged in age from 6 to 14. Here's what Vicky says about her 2 sons.
My oldest, he still shakes when he hears anybody talking about the fire. And the youngest one, he just doesn't like talking about it.
And notably, their youngest son was involved in an episode that I wasn't able to include in our earlier segments. And so when these kids were running to the lake, they themselves got separated and had to split into a few different cars. And their youngest son was actually left behind for a spell. A car had stopped to pick him up, but they apparently got spooked by how close the flames were. And after opening a car door for him, they closed it again and took off. He did catch another ride just fine, but Vicky says he still asks, why would people leave a kid behind? But for Vicky and Rolando themselves, you know, they're relatively clear-eyed about the whole experience, and they really focus on the positives. Yes, they lost everything they brought with them. Yes, it was a traumatic, you know, weekend, but they still have each other.
I don't know. I feel like that brought us more, like, together as a family, living that experience. You can die at any moment. You just got to enjoy your family. Do good all the time.
And just last month, Vicky had a baby, their 3rd child, a baby girl.
Oh, that's fantastic news.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was that emotional roller coaster ride with their puppy, who they thought they lost forever, but then ended up being rescued.
Yeah. Wasn't that just an incredible story?
Amazing.
Yeah. So Loki, their puppy, was rescued along with a group of guys that were all huddled in a quad that was parked in a creek during the fire. So this particular quad model, it's called a Razor, and it's pretty distinctive looking, kind of like the skeleton of a Jeep. Well, people had parked 2 of these Razors in the creek in the hopes that the water would help them survive the flames. Well, Vicky and Rolando ride Razors a lot. And so what they think happened is that once Loki was basically tossed out of a truck and on his own, he trotted into the woods to find refuge, and the sight of these 2 Razors would have been familiar to him. So he stayed there, was in fact protected from the flames, and that's where that group of guys found him before they were all rescued later in the day.
You briefly mentioned another dog in the series, and that's the puppy that came along with Alex Tedamati and Raul Reyes, 2 others who belonged to an off-roading club with Vicky and Rolando. What happened to that dog?
So this was another sidebar I didn't have time for. He is fine, though his story isn't nearly as traumatic as Loki's, and it's actually quite funny. So Their puppy, his name is Cash. They had a crate for him in their truck, so they had no trouble bringing him with them to the lake, but they were worried about whether they could bring him in the helicopter with them. You know, they found out later that yes, anybody with a heartbeat basically was welcome in those rescue choppers, but they didn't know that at the time. So they literally wrapped Cash up in a blanket like a baby and held him, passing him back and forth during the flight. But here's the thing, Cash is a mastiff. And so even though he was a puppy, he still weighed 40 pounds at the time. So you can imagine how uncomfortable this, you know, 60-minute flight would have been for them.
Wow, that is amazing. And a good, fortunately, another good outcome. And what Indeed. About Alex and Raul themselves? How are they faring now?
Well, at first it was tough for them, like it was for anyone there. You know, if you recall, while Alex was talking to the 911 dispatcher, Raul was driving their truck, which ended up shuttling 17 people to the lake. For a while after this episode was over, Raul says he had nightmares about people falling off the truck and getting hurt while he was driving. As we now know, that did happen with Carla's cousin in another truck, but not with anyone riding with Raul. Now, they're both able to look back at this experience, you know, pretty lucidly. They've also both been camping again with that off-roading group who had been at Mammoth Pool that weekend. The difference now, though, is that they've been staying away from really wooded areas and finding places to camp that have more than one way out. Plus, Alex says they all have a lot more respect for fire.
Yeah, we just don't mess around with fire no more. Like, if the sun is orange, I'm out of there. I don't care where I'm at. I don't care if I'm in the city. I don't care. I'm gone. I don't play no more.
And then other things that I heard from Alex and Raul and Vicky and Rolando are that, you know, they're thinking a lot more about emergency plans and escape routes. They're taking inventory of all their belongings when they go camping, and they also take pictures of everything.
That certainly makes sense. Mm-hmm. And you said that all of this took place on Alex's birthday. Does this blemish the day for her at all? You know, the fact that she has to associate her birthday with this trauma.
No, she says no way, amazingly. And in fact, she sort of already had this conversation with Vicky and Rolando's nephew back at the lake while they were still waiting to be rescued.
He came up to me and he was bawling and he was like, Alex, I'm so, so sorry. I was like, baby, what's wrong? And he said, I'm sorry, this is the worst birthday you've ever had. I was like, baby, this is not the worst birthday I've ever had. I'm not going to die today.
So what can we look forward to in next week's episode?
Well, next week, we plan to run an extended interview with Chief Joseph Rosamond. He was the helicopter pilot with the National Guard who flew the Chinook that rescued so many of those campers. There was much more to our conversation than we could include so far, including, you know, just what made these flights so risky compared to his active combat missions. And then, you know, a little bit about whether he regrets any of the risks that they took in loading so full with passengers.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Alex Burke. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.